Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Thanks for that, Pasana. Yeah. Thanks for that nice kirtan. It's really good to walk into a kirtan. Oh. So we're reading the Hamsaguya prayers. Prayers offered by Prajapati Daksha. So, Prajapati Daksha is offering these prayers to the Supreme Personality of Godhead to become pleased with him for those prayers. And, of course, Daksha's performing his activities as a Prajapati, but he's not properly generating all kinds of living entities as desired, and therefore he's praying to the Lord so that he may be successful. Text number 23. Prajapati Daksha said, "The Supreme Personality of Godhead is transcendental to the illusory energy and the physical categories it produces. He possesses the potency for unfailing knowledge and supreme willpower. And he is a controller of the living entities and the illusory energy. The conditioned souls who have accepted this material manifestation as everything cannot see him, for he is above the evidence of experimental knowledge. Self-evident and self-sufficient, he is not caused by any superior cause. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto him." So, he is explaining that the Lord is superior to the living entity, the material energy, and the products of the material energy, or the combination of both. And yet he is... this is not understood by living entities in general. So then he goes on to say, "As the sense objects, form, taste, touch, smell and sound, cannot understand how the senses perceive them, so the conditioned soul, although residing in his body along with the super soul, cannot understand how the Supreme Spiritual Person, the master of the material creation, directs his senses. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto that Supreme Person who is the Supreme Controller." So Prajapati Daksha is offering his obeisances under the Supreme Soul, the super soul, even though unable to see him. Prabhupada gives another analogy to help us understand that although ordinary citizens work under the direction of the government, they cannot understand how they are being governed or what the government is. So this verse elaborating on that unseen Lord. So, of course, Daksha is offering prayers to the Lord because Daksha is unable to he knows that in order to fulfill his duty, his activities, he's dependent upon the Supreme Lord, and only by the grace of the Supreme Lord will he actually be able to do this. And yet he knows, in another sense, that Lord is very difficult to perceive or unseen. But even though he's, the Lord is difficult to see, to know, to understand, that doesn't mean that he doesn't exist. Still, we require to take shelter of him. As Prabhupada gives the example here, even though we may not know how the government is working, or we may not know the personalities involved in the government, we do know that we depend upon them, and we can't function in this country without a government who's making so many vast, elaborate arrangements. So he goes on to say, because they are only matter, the body, the life airs, the external and internal senses, the five gross elements and the subtle sense objects, form, taste, smell, sound and touch, cannot know their own nature, the nature of the other senses or the nature of their controllers. But the living being, because of his spiritual nature, can know his body, the life airs, the senses, the elements and the sense objects, and he can also know the three qualities that form their roots. Nevertheless, although the living entity is completely aware of them, he is unable to see the Supreme Being, who is omniscient and unlimited. I therefore offer my respectful obeisances unto him. So, although there's many material things that we can know because we are a living being, that Supreme Lord is beyond the limited senses. Verse 26, when one's consciousness is completely purified of the contamination of material existence, gross and subtle, without being agitated as in the working and dreaming states, and when the mind is not dissolved as in sushupti, deep sleep, one comes to the platform of trance. Then one's material vision and the memories of the mind which manifest names and forms are vanquished. Only in such a trance is the Supreme Personality of Godhead revealed. Thus let us offer our respectful obeisances unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is seen in that uncontaminated transcendental state. Srila Prabhupada mentions there are two stages of God realization. One is called Sugeyam, or very easily understood, generally by mental speculation, and the other is called Durgeyam, understood only with difficulty. Paramatma realization and Brahman realization are considered Sugeyam. A realization of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is Durgeyam, as described here. One attains the ultimate realization of the Personality of Godhead when one gives up the activities of the mind, thinking, feeling and willing, or in other words, when mental speculation stops. This transcendental realization is above sushupti, deep sleep. In our gross conditional state, we perceive things through material experience and remembrance. And in the subtle stage, we perceive the world in dreams. The process of vision also involves remembrance and also exists in a subtle form. Above gross experience and dreams is susupti, deep sleep. And when one comes to the completely spiritual platform transcending deep sleep, he attains trance, visuddhisattva or visuddhisattva, in which the Personality of Godhead is revealed. There's a verse quoted here by Srila Visvanatha Chakrabarti Thakura from the 10th canto. One whose heart has become completely purified, my Lord, can understand the transcendental qualities of your Lordship and can understand the greatness of your activities. So this is the devotee, the process of devotional service, and Bhagavan. So bhakti, the bhakta, and Bhagavan are all unknown by the material mind and senses. But when the mind and the senses become purified or spiritualized by being engaged in devotional service, then the Lord actually reveals himself, the process of bhakti, and the devotee, that they are all revealed. Verses 27-28. Just as the great learned brahmanas who are expert in performing ritualistic ceremonies and sacrifices can extract the fire dormant within wooden fuel by chanting the 15 Samhitini mantras, thus providing the efficacy of the Vedic mantras, so those who are actually advancing consciousness, in other words, those who are Krishna conscious, can find the super soul who is... who by his own spiritual potency is situated within the heart. The heart is covered by the three modes of material nature and the nine material elements, and also by the five material elements and the 10 senses. These 27 elements constitute the external energy of the Lord. Great yogis meditate upon the Lord, who is situated as the super soul Paramatma within the core of the heart. May that super soul be pleased with me. The super soul is realized when one is eager for liberation from the unlimited varieties of material life. One actually attains such liberation when he engages in the transcendental loving service of the Lord and realizes the Lord because of his attitude of service. The Lord may be addressed by various spiritual names which are inconceivable to the material senses. When will that Supreme Personality of Godhead be pleased with me? So, in the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada quotes this verse in the Bhagavad Gita in his purport that persons who have acted piously in previous lives and in this life, whose sinful actions are completely eradicated and who are free from the duality of delusion, engage themselves in my service with determination. Always chanting my glories, endeavouring with great determination, bowing down before me, these great souls perpetually worship me with devotion. Srila Prabhupada summarises that one can understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead after transcending all material impediments. So, a variety of different verses substantiating the same point. Thus, although the subject matter is durvigyayam, extremely difficult to understand, although it is, it becomes easy if one follows the prescribed method. Coming in touch with the Supreme Personality of Godhead is possible through pure devotional service, which begins with Shravanam, Kirtan, and Vishnu. So, in this purport, it describes that an example given in this connection is that extracting fire from wood is certainly difficult, but when the fire comes out, it burns the wood to ashes. In other words, experiencing the Supreme Personality of Godhead is extremely difficult for those devoid of devotional service, but everything becomes easier for a devotee, and thus can be very easily met. One can very easily meet the Supreme Lord. Text number 29. Anything expressed by material vibrations, anything ascertained by material intelligence, and anything experienced by the material senses, or concocted within the material mind, is but an effect of the modes of material nature and therefore has nothing to do with the real nature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Supreme Lord is beyond the creation of this material world, for he is the source of the material qualities and creation. As the cause of all causes, he exists before the creation and after the creation. I wish to offer my respectful obeisances unto him. So, as mentioned in this purport, in praying to the Lord, Daksha does not wish material names and forms to be the objects of his worship. Rather, he wants to worship the Lord who existed before the creation of material dictionaries and names. Text number 30. The Supreme Brahman, Krishna, is the ultimate resting place and source of everything. Everything is done by him, everything belongs to him, and everything is offered to him. He is the ultimate objective, and whether acting or causing others to act, he is the ultimate doer. There are many causes, high and low, but since he is the cause of all causes, he is well known as the Supreme Brahman who existed before all activities. He is without a second and has no other cause. I therefore offer my respects unto him. Text 31. Let me offer respectful obeisances unto the all-pervading Supreme Personality of Godhead, who possesses unlimited transcendental qualities, acting from within the cause of the hearts of all philosophers who propagate various views. He causes them to forget their own souls, while sometimes agreeing and sometimes disagreeing among themselves. Thus he creates within this material world a situation in which they are unable to come to a conclusion. I offer my obeisances unto him. So we have so many philosophers discussing various philosophies, and yet in those philosophical discussions they actually forget their own eternal identity. What to speak of coming to a conclusion about the personality of Godhead. Text number 32. Asti ti nasti cha vastu nishtaya eka stayo vina virudha dharmanaha avikshitam kinchina yoga sankhyaya samam param yanukulam vihatta. There are two parties, namely the theist and the atheist. The theist who accepts the supersoul finds the spiritual cause through mystic yoga. The Sankhyite, however, who merely analyzes the material elements, comes to a conclusion of impersonalism and does not accept a supreme cause, whether Bhagavan, Paramatma, or even Brahman. Indeed, he is preoccupied with the superfluous external activities of material nature. Ultimately, however, both parties demonstrate the absolute truth, because although they offer opposing statements, their object is the same ultimate cause. They are both approaching the same Supreme Brahman, to whom I offer my respectful obeisances. So, in Srila Prabhupada's purport, he mentions the devotee tries to come directly in touch with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whereas the yogi tries to find the supersoul within the heart by meditation. Thus, both directly and indirectly, yoga means bhakti yoga. Sankhya, however, means physical study of the cosmic situation through speculative knowledge. This is generally known as jnana shastra. The Sankhyites are attached to the impersonal Brahman, but the absolute truth is known in three ways, as the Brahman, the Supersoul, and Bhagavan. But the central point is the absolute truth. Although the impersonalists and personalists fight with one another, they focus upon the Supreme Parabrahman, the Absolute Truth. So one's just like the personalists are describing the beautiful form of the Lord, and the impersonalists are describing how that Absolute Truth has no form. But in essence, they're both describing the absolute truth. That's the focus of attention. Although it's their focus of attention, one is offending the Lord and one is glorifying Him. The Sankites or Jnanis deny the material form, and the devotees also know very well that the absolute truth, Bhagavan, has no material form. Sankhyites and yogis are both situated in that same Brahman, but they differ because of different angles of vision. The bhaktas know that the Supreme Person has no material form, whereas jnanis simply deny the material form. One should therefore take shelter of the bhakti marg, the path of devotion. Then everything will be clear. Jnanis concentrate on the Virata Rupa, the gigantic universal form of the Lord. This is a good system in the beginning for those who are extremely materialistic, but there is no need to think continuously of the Virata Rupa. So, in essence, they're fighting over the same thing. They're both situated in the absolute truth and they're both fighting over the absolute truth. The cause of their quarrels is the absolute truth. And so everything is revolving around the absolute truth, and therefore Daksha offers his obeisances to the absolute truth. Piece number 33. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is inconceivably opulent, who is devoid of all material names, forms and pastimes, and who is all-pervading, is especially merciful to the devotees who worship his lotus feet. Thus he exhibits transcendental forms and names with his different pastimes. May that Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose form is eternal and full of knowledge and bliss, be merciful to me. So, you know, Sridhar Swami quoting the word anama, which means having no name, indicates that the Supreme Personality of Godhead has no material name. Simply by chanting the name of Narayan to call his son, Arjamil attains salvation. This means that Narayan is not an ordinary mundane name. It is non-material. The word anama, therefore, indicates that the names of the Supreme Lord do not belong to this material world. So, you know, that's interesting because, you know, in different scriptures, you know, Christianity, Muslim, you know, different places like that, people who represent those different religions quite often, you know, quote that the Lord has no name, and you know, they become disturbed that when, you know, we say, oh, God's name is Krishna, and they say, well, God has no name, like that. And, you know, when you hear the conversations where Srila Prabhupada is discussing with those persons, he agrees with them, because it's actually stated here that the Lord has no name. And so you know, one of the first things Prabhupada can do is say, yes, yes, that's right. You know, God cannot, God doesn't have a name, because he has no material name. But then he'll just say very simply, but according to his qualities and activities, you know, he has names. So this is a little bit of an example of what was stated previously, that Daksha's saying, one person is arguing about the absolute truth in this way and another person is arguing in the opposite way, but in the long run they're actually discussing the absolute truth and the cause of those philosophers, and the cause of their argument is in fact the absolute truth himself. So this is an example. You get Srila Prabhupada representing the personalist, describing the Lord and the glories of his holy name, and the impersonalist saying God has no name. So that's an example. But that whole discussion is focused around the absolute truth. Both the person arguing against the Lord having names, they're also discussing the absolute truth, and they're also discussing the holy name of the Lord. They're also hearing the Hare Krishna, the names of the Lord. And sometimes in that discussions, the Christians or those from a Judaic background may quote that. I think it was Moses, when he was given the Ten Commandments. Well, there were a whole lot more, actually. There was over 100 of them, I think, of which 10 were principal. And, in that conversation, he says, "Who are you?" And he says, "I am that I am." So, from that, they take it that... he has no name. I am that I am. So I exist. Who are you? I am that I am. So he didn't give a name. So they take it that he exists, but he merely exists, but he doesn't have a name. That's what they derive from that statement. We take a whole different perspective. When someone says, "I am," that means he's a person. So they say, "I am that I am," means that, something exists. So there's existence, but there's no name or, nothing else is discussed, form or anything like that. Just existence, something exists. But as soon as, they don't understand, as soon as someone says, "I exist," means that there's a personal identity as a person existing. So it must be a person. So, that's how you properly take it. But they don't, string that logical thought together. So they actually take the same statement as a statement that the Supreme is impersonal. And we take the very same statement that, he's a person. The argument is there. And we take the same statement. They take that statement that therefore the Lord has no name. And we take the same statement that yes, the Lord has no material name. But because he's a person, means that he has qualities, because a person has qualities, and they're transcendental qualities. Therefore, according to those transcendental qualities, he has transcendental names. So, it gets very technical, but if you actually, we present the holy name to people, and for many people they will argue these technicalities for hours and hours and hours, and it's very, very hard to convince them, that the Lord's holy names are spiritual, and these are some of the arguments that take place. The interesting thing here is that in our own scripture it also states that the Lord has no name, a nama. So we can agree with them. And that's what Prabhupada does, he would often agree, yes. And say, "The Lord has no name," and you expect Prabhupada to say, Oh no, he has hundreds of millions in it. But he agrees. Yes, that's right, of course. How can the Lord have a name? Is he under material person? But then he'll go on to say, but according to his transcendental qualities, he has so many names. So then he, after agreeing, he also disagrees. Any comments on that? Have you ever heard any of those conversations with Prabhupada discussing? Yeah. There's a few of them about the no name theory. And it's very similar, you know, it's very similar to, you know, where he's, you know, the Lord is described as having no form. It's just, we use the same argument. The scriptures, you know, in many places in the scriptures describes the Lord has no form. And we agree with that. And the Ishapanishad says, you know, he has no legs, but he can run faster than, you know, everyone. You know, he has no hands, but he accepts everyone's offer. So it's the same thing with the name like that. Yes, he has no name, but he does have names, transcendental, like that. So that's how we accept it accordingly. Like that verse from the Ishapanishad. And Dutch is saying, so they're arguing back and forth like this, but the focus of both of them is, in fact, the absolute truth. And, you know, that in itself is an interesting statement because, you know, if you look at practically every culture, every civilization, they have some sense of God or gods. And throughout all of time, people argue that that God or those gods don't exist, and others argue that they do exist. You know, so the fact that that discussion goes on tends to indicate that they're arguing about something because it exists. So for instance, you don't hear people for thousands of years, you know, arguing about a pink crocodile, you know, walking around in Ugg boots. Because, you know, it just obviously doesn't exist. But the fact that they, you know, you go to one country, you go back thousands of years, they've never been to other parts of the world, and they're arguing about something which people say doesn't exist, and you go 1,000 years back and you go to another, and they're arguing about the same thing. You know, you'd think it would be really strange if you go back 500 years and you go to ancient Greece and they're arguing about pink crocodile in Ugg boots. And then 1,000 years before that in Fiji, they're arguing about a pink crocodile in Ugg boots. You'd think, maybe this pink crocodile in Ugg boots, you know, exist because everyone seems to be talking about, you know, this strange thing that no one's ever seen. You'd think maybe it exists because everyone's talking about it. Some are for, some are, you know, see what I mean? So the fact that this discussion is practically, you know, since time immemorial about God, does he exist, doesn't, tends to indicate that something exists that they're arguing about, and some are for and some are against. So, you know, it's an interesting sort of conversation that, you know, or a set of prayers that he's offering, but in essence his statements are, you know, the same, that he has to exist, otherwise why do these philosophical discussions just continue to happen, you know, everywhere at all times? That tends to prove that he exists. Then he says, so at the end, you know, after we accept the Bhagavatam version that the Lord has no, you can call him Annama, no name. And then in Prabhupada's purport he says, although his original name is Krishna, Krishna's true Bhagavan Swayam, he acts in unlimited ways and therefore according to his work he has many, many thousands of names. That's our ultimate conclusion, that statement there, very important statement. His original name is Krishna. Because Krishna is the original form of the personality of Godhead, the original complete form of the personality of Godhead. And that original and complete form of the personality of Godhead has unlimited transcendental qualities which are all attractive, and therefore his name is Krishna. That's his original name. And then he goes on to say, as the air carries various characteristics of the physical elements, like the aroma of a flower or colours resulting from a mixture of dust in the air, the Lord appears through lower systems of worship according to one's desires, and he appears as the demigods and not in his original form. What is the use of these other forms? May the original Supreme Personality of Godhead fulfil my desire. We'll read this verse, an important discussion about Panchaprasanna. The impersonalists imagine the various demigods to be forms of the Lord. For example, the Mayavadis worship five demigods, Panchaprasanna. They do not actually believe in the form of the Lord, but for the sake of worship they imagine some form to be God. Generally, they imagine a form of Vishnu, a form of Shiva, and forms of Ganesh, the sun god, and Durga. This is called Panchaprasanna. Daksha, however, wanted to worship not an imaginary form, but the supreme form of Lord Krishna. Now, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is describing the difference between the Supreme Personality of Godhead and an ordinary living being by summarising some of the previous verses, that the omnipotent Supreme Lord knows everything, but the living being does not actually know the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that was one of Daksha's prayers, and that makes a big distinction between the living entity and the personality of Godhead. They are not one and the same. And that ordinary living entity, he does not actually know the Supreme Personality of Godhead, nor can he understand him through speculative knowledge or by imagination. One must therefore know the Supreme Personality of Godhead by the grace of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He reveals himself, but he cannot be understood by speculation, and as we describe, he is understood through the process of bhakti. One engages in the service of the Lord. So, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments that this verse is especially meant for the impersonalist, who thinks that he himself is the supreme because there is no difference between the living being and God. So they think like that. But as Daksha is describing in his verses, there are significant differences. The Mayavadi philosopher thinks that there is only one supreme truth and that he is also that supreme truth. There are three classes of men, the lowest, Adama, those in the middle, Majjhima, and the best, Uttama. The lowest, Adama, think that there is no difference between God and the living entity, except that the living entity is under designations, where the absolute truth has no designations. In their opinion, as soon as the designations of the material body are dissolved, the jiva, the living entity, will mix with the supreme. They give the argument of katakasa patakasa, in which the body is compared to a pot with the sky within, the sky within and the sky without. When the pot breaks, the sky inside becomes one with the sky outside, and so the impersonalists say that the living being becomes one with the supreme. This is their argument, but Srila Madhvacharya says that such an argument is put forward by the lowest class of men. So, you know, they have the Panchapasana, and basically because the Lord is one, he exists within all the different forms, especially those five forms. And when those five forms are dissolved, you know, that one absolute truth that's within them, again reveals, you know, its oneness without the designations of those particular bodies and forms. Now, another class of men cannot ascertain what the actual form of the Supreme is, but they agree that there is a Supreme who controls the activities of the ordinary living being. Such philosophers are accepted as mediocre. The best, however, are those who understand the Supreme Lord, Satchidananda Vigraha. His form is completely spiritual, full of bliss, and completely distinct from that of the conditioned soul or any other living entity. Such philosophers are the best because they know that the Supreme Personality of Godhead reveals himself differently to worshippers in various modes of material nature. They know that there are 33 million demigods, just to convince the conditioned soul that there is a supreme power and to induce him to agree to worship one of these demigods, so that by the association of devotees he may be able to understand that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. See, that's quite a big summary of the whole discussion on the Lord and the demigods. So Krishna says, there is no truth superior to me. I am the origin of all the demigods. I am superior to everyone, even Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and the other demigods. These are the conclusions of the Shastra, and one who accepts these conclusions should be considered a first-class philosopher. Such a philosopher knows that the Supreme Person of Godhead is the Lord of all the demigods. So, Daksha is distinguishing the Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, from the various demigods. He wants to worship that Supreme Personality of Godhead, Bhagavan. And he understands that that one Supreme Personality of Godhead, Bhagavan, he does appear as the various demigods and not his original form. And he does so because of the worshippers' lack of spiritual qualification, and because they're under the material conceptions in sattva, rajas and tamas. But by manifesting himself as so many different demigods, it is none other than Krishna, but they're forced to accept Krishna's, they're forced to accept the authority of the Vedas, and they're forced to accept an authority within the universe. By at least accepting an authority, they have an opportunity that within that system they'll associate with devotees, and gradually they'll be brought to know, understand the person. I've got it. So, someone who is, we were discussing this the other day about Gayatri. Someone who has a complete materialistic understanding, there is no possibility for them to understand or accept if you explain to them that in the spiritual world there is an eternal form of the Lord who exists. And you know, they will not accept that. You know, there's no eternal forms. There's no eternal form of the Lord. It's like an energy, vast energy, which is just all-pervading oneness, and we just merge into that. There's no way you can convince them. Now, if they believe that, and they live in this world, then they live in this world under the concept that there is no control or higher authority that can dictate to them what they should and should not do. There is no God per se who can tell them what is, this is right and this is wrong. So a lot of people accept religion because of this. Who are you to say you put something in a Bible or some scripture and tell me what I can do and what I should accept as right and wrong? This is their argument. You put it in your Bible and you tell me that I have to accept that this is right and that's wrong. How dare you? I think that's what, you know, they become indignant. Why are they indignant? Because of your, you know, ridiculous, you know, nonsense that there's some personality called God. How can there be some person who lives forever and, you know, what is it? It's just not possible, see? So therefore, you know, if God doesn't exist, you know, then how dare you, you know, in the name of this God who doesn't exist, put these things in these scriptures and tell me what I should think, what is right and wrong, and what I should do and what I should. So there's no authority. So then you take those personalities and you say, yes, okay, you know, there's no God. Ultimately, just everything merges into the energy and just exists forever. But there are very powerful material beings within the material. And they say, oh, okay. You know, that they don't live forever, but they're quite powerful and somehow they have some... So that they can accept, to, you know. That's about as far as they get. So then they'll understand, so these powerful personalities, they're saying, I can do this and I can't do this, so I'll accept that. And one of the things that I should do is to be respectful to the brahmanas and those, you know, and the sadhus and like that. So they can accept that. And because they accept that, they get the opportunity that amongst those sadhus are some devotees, and when they associate with those devotees, they gradually, through the devotees' expert preaching and what have you, and purification, they come to gradually go from Brahman to Paramatma to Bhagavan realization. So the Lord appears in the form of the demigods because in that form they will accept him. It's Krishna himself manifest through his energies. The 33 million demigods are none other than Krishna manifesting in a way that they can at least appreciate some sense of authority and instruction within, you know, the universe, and that gives them the opportunity, therefore, some opportunity to accept the, you know, sadhus and what have you. So that's what Shiva is saying. But you know, but he's praying to that original personality himself, and not in the forms that people, you know, imagine to be, you know, God, those, you know, the demigods. They're not actually God. You know, the supreme, the Bhagavan is actually Krishna. The forms of Ganesh, they appear and disappear, they're imaginary. So they're his prayers. So his dismantling a lot of false notions about the Supreme Lord. So it's very pleasing. You imagine that's very pleasing to Krishna, that he's offered, you know, he's recognizing that, you know, Bhagavan is a person. Sri Sukadeva Goswami said, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, who is extremely affectionate to his devotees, was very pleased by the prayers offered by Daksha, and thus he appeared at that holy place known as Agamarshana. But Maharaj Parikshit, best of the Kuru dynasty, the Lord's lotus feet rested on the shoulders of his carrier, Garuda, and he appeared with 8 long, mighty, very beautiful arms. In his hands he held a disc, conch shell, sword, shield, arrow, bow, rope and club. In each hand a different weapon was brilliant, all brilliantly shining. His garments were yellow and his bodily hue deep bluish. His eyes and face were very cheerful, and from his neck to his feet hung a long garland of flowers. His chest was decorated with a Kastuba jewel and the mark of Shivats. On his head was a gorgeous round helmet, and his ears were decorated with earrings resembling sharks. All these ornaments were uncommonly beautiful. The Lord wore a golden belt on his waist, bracelets on his arms, rings on his fingers, and ankle bells on his feet. Thus decorated by various ornaments, Lord Hari, who is attractive to all the living entities of the three worlds, is known as Purushottam, the best personality. He was accompanied by great devotees like Narada, Nanda, and all the principal demigods, led by the heavenly king Indra, and the residents of various upper planetary systems such as Siddhaloka, Gandharvaloka, and Chanaraloka. Situated on both sides of the Lord and behind him as well, these devotees offered him prayers continuously. Seeing that wonderful and effulgent form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Prajapati Daksha was first somewhat afraid, but then he was very pleased to see the Lord, and he fell to the ground like a stick to offer his respects to the Lord. As rivers are filled with water, by water flowing from a mountain, all of Daksha's senses were filled with pleasure. Because of his highly elevated happiness, Daksha could not say anything, but simply remained flat on the ground. Although Prajapati Daksha could not say anything, when the Lord, who knows everyone's heart, saw his devotee prostrate in that manner and desiring to increase the population, he addressed him as follows. Sri Bhagavan Vacha. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, O most fortunate Prachitasa, because of your great faith in me, you have attained the supreme devotional ecstasy. Indeed, because of your austerities combined with exalted devotion, your life is now successful. You have achieved complete perfection. My dear Prajapati Daksha, you have performed extreme austerities for the welfare and growth of the world. My desire also is that everyone within this world be happy. I am therefore very pleased with you because you are endeavouring to fulfil my desire for the welfare of the entire world. Prabhupada mentions in his purport to this verse, he says, unless a living entity surrenders to Krishna, he must continue this life of struggle. The Krishna consciousness movement is not a fad. It is a bona fide movement intended to promote the welfare of all conditioned souls by trying to elevate everyone to the platform of Krishna consciousness. If one does not come to this platform, he must continue in material existence perpetually, sometimes in the upper planets and sometimes in the lower planets. Prajapati Daksha is trying to benefit the conditioned souls by forgetting them to give them a life with a chance for liberation. Similarly, when the spiritual master trains the conditioned souls to become Krishna conscious, his position is successful. If one gives the conditioned souls a chance to become Krishna conscious, all his activities are approved by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is extremely pleased, as stated here. Following the examples of the previous acharyas, all the members of the Krishna consciousness movement should try to benefit the conditioned souls by inducing them to become Krishna conscious and giving them all facilities to do so. Such activities constitute real welfare work. By such activities, a preacher or anyone who endeavours to spread Krishna consciousness is recognised by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And this is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. For one who explains the supreme secret to the devotees, devotional service is guaranteed, and at the end he will come back to me. There is no servant in this world more dear to me than he, nor will there ever be one more dear. So, remember at the beginning of this unit we described it. The question to answer in the essay is the mood and mission. So here's another mood and mission statement. You want to note that down in your because when you do your essay, you know, it is these statements here which are extremely significant. You know, this is one of the one of the most significant contributions of ISKCON compared to, you know, even other followers of the Vedas and even other Vaishnavas, is this preaching mirror, this preaching spirit. It's significant to the world because it benefits the world. It's significant to us trying to become devotees of the Lord rather than becoming affiliated with other Vaishnava lines, because when you preach Krishna consciousness, here Prabhupada says one is recognized by the Lord, but quite often he'll say in his lectures one is immediately recognized by the Lord. Now, if you want immediate recognition, you know, so you can, in other words, you can perform devotional service for many, 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 many years. If that's done primarily for your own Krishna consciousness, you know, it's accepted. But in a very short time, even from the very first day of being a devotee, if you actually act for the benefit of preaching to help others become Krishna conscious, you get an immediate recognition from the Lord straight away, just immediately. Because Krishna will let you know from day one, this is the thing that pleases me the most. So you get immediate recognition. Krishna will show you from the very beginning of your devotional life. You know, if you preach Krishna consciousness, he'll just give you a Master says, devotional service is guaranteed. Devotional service is guaranteed means that you get an immediate understanding, very quick understanding of what devotional service is, how it's done properly, and what not to do as a devotee. You understand that very quickly. You get the ability to recognize very quickly who is a nice devotee, who is the young devotee, you know, where you can take it, a good association. And you get very immediate understanding of the transcendental qualities and pastimes of Lord Sri Krishna. You know, we discuss, the pastimes of Lord Sri Krishna, even the pastimes of Krishna with the gopis and Srimati Radharani and the Brajabasis. And you find that, and the pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and you find that the devotees, they just get admit, yes, Krishna and Radharani, Radharani is Krishna's eternal, full spiritual pleasure potency. Krishna is the personality of Godhead, and the interaction or the loving exchange between Radharani and her expansions as the gopis and Krishna is a completely transcendental activity. And, you try and explain that to even Vaishnavas, who are great pundits and, in Vaishnava philosophy and literature, they can't understand it. They don't even accept Krishna or the Radharani like that. And yet you get someone who comes along and they're trying to, distribute Prabhupada's books and, do something for the preaching. And immediately they can understand it. Oh, I can understand that. I can accept that. Yeah, that makes sense. So, I look back, with great fascination how literally, you can almost be picked up from the streets and, you're hearing Srimad Bhagavatam within the first few days and you just, oh yeah, I understand that, yeah, I accept that, I don't. Because somehow Krishna has immediately recognized you from the very beginning. Oh, I'll let him understand. You hear Daksha's prayers. For millions of years. I mean, this is going back to, there was Swayam Bilga Manu, and then we jumped to the Chakshusha Manu. So we're still going back millions of years. And you see, he's saying that in his time, this Pancho Prasanna, that's perpetual misunderstanding, which manifests as this impersonalism and Pancha Prasanna worship of the primary demigods and what have you. That type of philosophy is going way back into the previous Manu, the Chakshusha Manu. For millions and millions of years, it just persists, this misunderstanding. Even, they come across this knowledge in the scriptures or even is presented to them. They cannot accept it, they cannot understand it. And here we are in the middle of Kali Yuga. Somehow you stumble into a Hare Krishna temple and you try to preach a little Krishna consciousness, do something, and then you hear this and immediately you understand it. How is that possible? See? That is because, Krishna is, he recognizes you from the very beginning. Yes, I recognize this devotee. Devotional service is guaranteed. Why is that? Because I'll let them understand devotional service from the very beginning. Right up to the point of, the Brajabasi, level of understanding. So devotional service is guaranteed for that person because they've walked in the door and I'll let them understand from the very beginning. Like that. And for those who they cannot understand, is this right? Krishna? Can't accept Krishna as God, Vishnu is God. So what's all this, Krishna and Radha, Vishnu is God, maybe Narayan, what is or the Dem or Shiva is God, or Ganesh. So how can I accept all this, Vajrabhasi sort of thing? So that understanding is there, that means devotional service is guaranteed. There's a realization. And how is that affected? Because somehow we tried to preach or we tried to serve the preachers. So, you know, Srila Prabhupada, you know, ISKCON is a preaching movement. Somehow we come along and we do something to serve Prabhupada, who's preaching Krishna consciousness through his books and what have you. And Krishna gives us that recognition. So that's the practical application of, you know, what it means to be recognized by Krishna. It's any comments on that?
Well, we can ask a question.
Mm.
So you have had this discussion.
Mm.
Now I've got same topic, two questions related.
Yeah.
So we have a scenario where, like a Mataji, she is asked, I think either Prabhupada or Guru Maharaj, I would like to preach.
Mm-hmm.
And Prabhupada asked her, how old is her child? Then she said, the child is about 6 months. Then Prabhupada says, no, we have no business to preach. We have to look after your child. That's one scenario. Then the other scenario where, like you said, sometimes immature devotees, they want to do preaching.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are behaving in a way that is, in a way, as if, like you said, when senior people are preaching, you come in and you just try to say that, as if you want to do the job. So, taking into this consideration, how do they, so they are in fact actually being offensive there. So, but their motive is to preach. So, how do they prove? And also in this scenario, like the same, sometimes Mataji feel that, okay, they're just spending their time looking out to the kids and doing this, they're not preaching.
Well, you know, as I've mentioned sometimes before in various classes, that, you know, Prabhupada, you know, one time someone was asking Prabhupada, you know, about his desire, you know, he was expressing his desire to preach Krishna consciousness, and, you know, and Prabhupada was saying that, you know, not everyone can preach, because he was indicating, you know, that what will you preach, you know, and have you studied the books, you know, someone comes along and says, I'd like to preach. Well, you know, what are you going to preach? Have you read the books? You're just going to go out and preach, you know, do you have an idea what it says in the Bhagavad Gita before you go out and preach, you know, what's in the Bhagavad Gita, have you read the Bhagavad Gita, do you understand that that's the basis, that's the book we're preaching from, or are you going out to preach, you know, some other, you know, for instance, I did a ceremony for a person a couple of days ago, and you know, I always like to find out, you know, what their background is, so that I have a platform that I can speak to them and relate to them. And usually what I like to do is ask them about their, you know, find out who they worship, you know, if they're, especially if they're from India, you know, what temples that their family would go to ordinarily. Are they going to the Shiva temple, the Daksha, not Daksha, but, you know, Shiva, you know, Ganesh, like that, you know. Shakti. So, you know, the man said to me, oh, we go to the Sai Baba temple. And I thought, okay, you didn't quite understand what I said. So I said, yeah. So what about your parents? You know, what's their favourite temple that they, and the, you know, yeah, the Sai Baba temple. I said, no. What about previous, you know, going way back in your family? Like, you know, I said, that's like a modern temple. Right, you know, Sai Baba, I'm talking about very ancient, you know. And they go, no, 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 that is very ancient. They've always worshipped Sai Baba like that. And I'm thinking, how is that, you know. I'm just trying to ask a simple question, of course I'm digging myself in a hole here by even asking these questions. So he said, yes, you know, they've always worshipped Sai Baba because Sai Baba is Vishnu avatar. And I said, really? I was really quite stunned, you know, by the foolishness of it, and trying to look like I wasn't stunned. But I said, See, you know, I haven't seen that anywhere in the scriptures. And he said, oh, it's in the scriptures. I said, which scripture? The Mahabharata. I said, oh, that's funny. I've read the Mahabharata, you know, and, you know, several times. I've never seen that in there. He said, yes, it's in there. He said, it's not actually in the book, it's on the DVD. So, now, this family, all of them were Sai Baba worshippers. As far as they were concerned, as far back as you go in history, right through the scriptures, that, you know, the bona fide process. And that temple is as ancient as any other temple, as good as any other temple in India. Now, so if such a person came along, sometimes they ask, can we do service? So imagine that person starts coming to the temple, they start cooking in the kitchen and things like that. And then after a couple of days, they think, oh, you guys are all preaching. I'd like to go out and preach as well. So our question would be, what are you going to preach? You know, isn't it? We'd be quite concerned that, you know... He says, yeah, I'll preach Mahabharata, Bhagavad Gita. Yeah, but, you know, have you actually read Bhagavad Gita as it is, or, you know, you're going to take it from the DVD? Because, you know, you can back it in on his DVD.
Yeah, the DVD,
have
you seen Mahabharata?
What's that?
You've seen Mahabharata, the DVD, many times?
Yeah.
I haven't come across
saying, you know, yeah, you probably have to go to the Sai Baba bookshop, you know, to the DVD shop to find that particular, you know.
Maybe he means to say that in one particular aspect, Sai Baba in his life, he shows the Virat Rupa.
Mm-hmm.
He shows
the Have you seen the DVD?
I have seen the DVD.
Yeah.
Is it on but the not Mahabharata DVD. Is
it on Mahabharata?
No, it's
Sai
Baba's
video.
It's
a
Sai Baba Bhagavad Gita.
No, he shows...
So Sai Baba shows his universal form. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then he should be incarnate.
Not exactly universal form, but how the lives, you know, that...
They're all coming from him. He's a visionary type.
In his whole body, he shows... Every limb of his body.
Which one?
Yeah. Because, I mean, some people accept that Jimi Hendrix also was an avatar. You know Jimi Hendrix? He's from the, you know, the 60s, the musician. You know, real, you know, I mean, he was always on LSD, always... But on the cover of one of his records, there's the picture of the universal form, and then, you know, Vishnu's face has been removed, and his face is there. Yeah, but, you know, in the 60s, you know, you would have accepted him as, like, you know, some, you know, incarnation, modern incarnation of Vishnu. Probably up until the point where he died and drowned in his own vomit after, you know, a bad case of ODing from drugs. Although they probably thought that's all part of his leela. Yeah, but the point is that, you know, if such persons come to the temple and they, you know, people can be in the temple for some time and even attending classes and all sorts of things and maintain, and then they're all ready to preach. And your question is, what are you going to preach? Have you read the books? And that's what Prabhupada would ask. You know, in the case with, you know, say the lady with the baby, you know, raise the baby, you know, keep chanting, do a little reading, but, you know, perhaps, you know, when, you know, that, you know, that in itself is a service. And when you have more time, you may then want to, you know, quite intensely study the books and then preach. But, you know, how is it really possible, you know, at that particular time that she's at, you know? I mean, certainly Prabhupada knows that she can, you know, preach, you know, within her, you know, environment, but on a, you know, a significant scale to take up some preaching project may be quite difficult. So when we say, it says there that Krishna immediately recognizes a preacher, and that from day one, you can preach, then, you know, that is there, just like Prabhupada used to talk about Saraswati. Saraswati was, you know, a little 5-year-old girl or something, and, you know, she used to just repeat what, you know, her father, Shamsundra or something, you know, and, you know, she would say to people to come to the temple or to the home, or that she'd be out in the street in the kirtan, whatever, and she'd go out to people and say, you know, do you know who the Supreme Personality of Godhead is? And they'd say, no, just Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this is like that. So Prabhupada says she was preaching because she was just repeating. But, you know, of course, the interesting thing there for a child, there's no confusion in her mind. Is it Sai Baba? Is it, you know, like Phyllis, you know, like that. She really only has one thing in her mind. It's just there's Krishna, there's nothing else. No other nonsense. She hasn't had time to be, you know, so it's like that. So there's an example where someone who's just a child, Prabhupada says they can preach. And then on other hand, we see where Prabhupada's talking to adults and saying, you know, what will you preach? And that not everyone can preach. See? So, in other words, you know, what we understand from that with Prabhupada is that where someone comes to Krishna consciousness, they hear from the devotees and they just accept it without any, you know, doubts, or without any, you know, they accept the authority of the devotees, or they hear from Prabhupada. Prabhupada says Krishna is the Supreme Person of Godhead. I just accept that because I can see the Prabhupada as, you know, so you meet Prabhupada and you think, wow, you know, he is a saintly person. If he says Krishna is, you know, supreme, I accept that, you know. I wouldn't argue with that. You know, you can just see he's like glowing. He's just like this transcendental personality. So then you go out and say Krishna is the Supreme Person of Godhead, that you don't know a lot more, you know, then that's also preaching. But if there are other things going on within your mind and heart, and when you're presenting what you've read, you're mixing that with the other stuff that's going on, then you can't preach. That's a problem, you know. So, you know, one, just someone innocently accepts, and they're obviously accepting in one sense because of, you know, the benediction of the saintly person, and perhaps because they're coming from previous lifetime as devotee. Another person may have, you know, begun to study or to hear, but there's a lot of other things going on in their mind and heart at the same time, and that may come out while they're saying, you know, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and Ganesh and Shiva and Shakti, at that you can accept all of them. You know. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but the origin is Vishnu. You know. So, you know, sometimes, as I've explained, I know of within the Indian congregation, because this is, you know, coming from many generations, you know, it's come down, and that Vishnu is the source of all the avatars, So, you know, they'll preach, you know, the Krishna is the Supreme Person of Godhead, but, you know, he's an expansion of Vishnu, and Vishnu is the origin of Krishna. So they're sort of saying it, but they've got a whole different take on it, you know, like that. You know, he's the Supreme Person, he's not different from Vishnu, who's, you know, actually the origin. So then how can that person preach? So preaching is very easy for someone who just... You know, that was one thing that Srila Prabhupada recognized within many of the people outside of India. Didn't matter really so much which part of the world, but they're outside of India. Because you say, you know, Krishna is the Supreme Person of God, and they say, oh, I didn't know that, you know. Oh, thank you for telling me that. And then they go out and preach that. And you tell someone in India, Krishna is the Supreme Person of Godhead, and they immediately bring so many thousands of other gods, you know, to compete with it. Because that's what's in their mind, and that's what's coming down for generations, and it's sort of like that. So, you know, then there's a difficulty at that. So, in one sense, you've got, you know, people who are actually brought up, you know, they're well-versed in the Gita, they're well-versed in the Mahabharata, they know all these stories, and they can't preach because there's other things coming out with us. And then you've got people who know nothing about it, and they've got about two sentences that they know that they've heard from Prabhupada of the books, and they can preach because they're just preaching that without anything else. So, you know, that's, you know, as far as my understanding is, you can see that there are...
That's not a scenario I'm talking about here. Mm. There are people who are... basically, who have even done Bhakti Shastri, say Bhakti Bhakti, maybe have done the teaching course also.
Mm-hmm.
But one scenario is that that they are really young.
Yeah.
It could be even a male. Sometimes there is a lot of responsibility in the family because the children are young. Mm. And then because they want to do a lot of activities here.
Mm.
Sometimes the kids, they feel, what is this for? I mean, they feel that they are missing out. In fact, there have been families where they're saying, Daddy, this is not all life.
That's a good point, yeah.
I would like to do something different than my friends.
Mm.
Why do we as a family always have to come here?
That's right.
And
that's
the
a very good
they
point.
Start, the kids, they start...
Mm.
They, in fact, they go away from Krishna consciousness because they feel that their requirement is not being met.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. So therefore,
that is one scenario.
That's right.
Where similar to the mother.
They have not molded their life in such a way where they can preach without causing some significant difficulty to their family. You know, or others, you know, things in their life that should go on. So, you know, Prabhupada certainly didn't want that, you know.
And then,
don't leave your baby at home and you're going out preaching.
No, they may come, they may bring the child here. But the child is spending the whole time here.
Well, don't drag the baby around while you're preaching, you know.
And so they are spending all the time preaching all that.
Yeah.
So the child feels that, okay, so we go home here. There's no other...
Disruptive.
That is a very common scenario that's happening in ISKCON at the moment.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's more so sometimes when people are living near the temple and the kids really feel that.
Yeah.
That's one scenario.
Mm.
The second scenario I was talking about is, yes, the person... may be attending all these classes and all that, but still their realization could be different.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's right.
In
that's,
a sense, they know the Supreme Personality of God is Krishna,
mm-hmm.
and they accept all that, they're chanting, and they could be even initiated. But still, it's not that they have the maturity to preach, but
that's
they
right.
want to preach.
Yeah.
And like you have said, sometimes,
mm-hmm.
when a senior person is coming, you should, and they are talking, you should just allow them to talk.
Mm.
But then they want to, out of passion, they want to do it. They
exactly.
sort of come.
Yeah.
I'm talking about, that's the second scenario I'm talking about.
That's right.
They want to preach.
Yeah.
Because this is what I should do. This is, in fact, sometimes people initiate. This is our Guru Maharaj has told us to do this. And so they want to do it. I'm talking about that scenario.
Yeah, and
those
that's
are the
right.
scenarios
yeah.
I'm talking about.
Yeah. And, you know.
So this.
Preaching also has.
When we say
yeah.
that Krishna will recognize this, in this statement, how do we justify saying that that's not the way to do things? How do we justify
it? Yeah. What's that verse? Is it the Chaitanya Charitamrita that, you know, only one empowered by the Lord, or unless you're empowered by the Lord, you cannot preach or, you know, spread the Krishna consciousness movement or something?
Krishna said,
yeah. Yeah, what's that one? What's the translation generally?
Krishna said, without the empowerment of the Lord, one cannot preach.
Yeah, basically, yeah, yeah. So, you know, there is a verse in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that, you know, without authorization by the Lord, or we say empowerment, you cannot preach as well. So in other words...
But how does that come here? Because...
Like you were saying...
They
you,
initiated.
Yeah,
and
you've
they,
got...
And Guru Maharaj
yeah.
said, no, you do preaching. That he just gently says, you spread this... You have received so much of mercy from the Lord, I want you to spread this mercy.
Yeah, well, you know, for instance, when the spiritual master says, yeah, you do preaching, it doesn't mean that, you know... Bhujan Prabhu happens to be on the asana giving morning class, and then, you know, that devotee walks in and says, oh, well, I was instructed to preach, move over, I'm sitting on the asana now.
No, may not be so gross.
No, it's not, but it, as you said it, other senior devotees are present and they just talk over the top of them. It's the same thing. You may as well just bump them off the asana because, you know, it's just the same thing going on. Oh, I've been instructed by Guru Maharaj to go and preach, you know. So, you know, I'm just going to talk over the top of you, even though you've been around for 20, 30 years longer than me. You see? So that's not authorised. That wasn't authorised. So, you know, to preach, one has to be authorised. And then, you know, if you get the general instruction to preach, you know, if the Guru says, you know, I want you to preach Krishna consciousness. And then, you know, one of the devotees says, oh, you know, I heard you preaching, you're preaching all sorts of nonsense. And says, my Guru Maharaj asked me to preach, but he never asked me to read the books, he never asked me to do any studies, he never asked me to listen to lectures, he just said preach. You know, but... so, you know... So when the spiritual master says, you know, I want you to preach, within that you would understand, you know, so it's like saying the father says to the son, when you grow up, I'd like you to be a doctor. Oh, so, you know, he gets to 21, he starts, you know, taking his friend's appendix out and, you know, his tonsils and pulling a few teeth out. But he never went to medical school. No, my father said he wanted me to be a doctor. You know, it's within the understanding that means you've got to get... So, you know...
what you're saying is a person who's, first of all, speaking over the senior person, he has not been... has not studied enough. He could have done Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Bhagavad, but the fact is he has
as soon as someone is talking over in the presence, over the top of a senior devotee, they're not qualified to preach.
In that itself, you may have studied anything,
they they've just revealed themselves.
Not
having
that
right.
Translation of the verse is, the fundamental religious system in the age of Kali is the chanting of the holy name of Krishna. Unless empowered by Krishna, one cannot propagate the Sankirtan movement.
So, you know, we're all, Krishna is saying in the Bhagavad Gita, one who preaches this message, there's no one more dear to me than that person. So, you know, there is a general indication from Krishna that he's literally authorizing, you know, you can all preach, you know, like, I want you all to preach. There's no one more dear to me. So, you know, we can take it that, you know, Krishna is saying, I want you to all to preach like that. There's authorizations coming. You know, Bhagavad Gita, preach Bhagavad Gita. But, you know, within that means that you'd have to understand what the Bhagavad Gita is and you know, follow the other principles of the Bhagavad Gita like that, you know. So, we don't take it like that. That, but, you know, quite often, you know, you can be very new in the movement. You can just literally within the first few days, you know, if you come to the movement as a clean slate, you know, that forget everything I know, I'm now, you know, trying to become a Hare Krishna, I'm going to take shelter of the devotees and, you know, try and understand. They've said to me to do this, so I'm just going to do what they've said to do, you know. That person can pretty much preach almost, you know, as much as what they're being authorized to do. I mean, you know, when I joined up, it was a lot easier because you really didn't open your mouth to preach unless you were actually asked to. You know, and, you know, in every situation where there was a devotee that had been around longer than you, you just didn't open your mouth until someone asked you to do something. Otherwise, it was automatically that you just listened to that devotee. That was automatic. If you're out selling books, of course, or what have you, then there's no other senior devotees. You know, okay, I've got to do it because they've asked me to come out here and do this. I can't, you know, there's no other senior devotees. I've got to do, and I've got to, you know, sort of do what I've seen them do. And they'll usually give you a few clues and what have you. And then you'll go back and you'll discuss that at the end of the day and they'll say, oh, don't do that again, don't say that again, try this one like that. So, you know, but that, it's not like that now, you know, that even if you say to devotees that come along that it's best to take a little bit of prompting from the senior devotees, they actually won't do it. You know, even if you tell them, they still won't do it. So, you know, that makes it more difficult. But, yeah. So the point is, if you preach and you're authorised to preach, because without being authorised, you can't preach. So that verse is very important. That, and we used to do that, you know, that authorization wasn't just the guru said, you know, it was any devotee who was senior to you, have they authorized me in their presence, am I authorized to speak? Any senior devotee that you're in the presence of, has that person, will he allow me to say something? If not, I'd keep quiet. That's, we took authorization to that level. Now you get a general instruction from the guru and it's, you know, a free-for-all. So does that make things a little clearer?
How would you say in the verse of this, how would you expand on this? And also that family that, I mean, I would like a little complete picture that yes, you should not do this, but you have to preach.
Yeah.
Okay. So like that actually when you're keeping quiet, that's also you're favoring preaching. And so that's also preaching.
Exactly, because
so,
you're,
I mean,
you're serving the preacher.
I just want to connect it.
Yeah.
So that means by when you're taking, like for example, when you're keeping quiet in the presence of a senior person, you're allowing them to preach. That's also you are considered as favoring preaching.
Exactly. But you're not just keeping quiet. You're there as a servant, which means that you're listening, so you're learning from them. That's part of your service. They want you to hear and learn, and because you're doing that, you're doing service. They may also say, can you run and get me that book? You're prepared to do that. You know, so you're there as a servant, and because you're serving the preacher, whatever they want to do, and you're learning from them, and in that way you're also a servant, therefore, you know, you're getting the benefit as a preacher.
That's also
oh yeah, you're getting the same benefit in the Chaitanya Charitamrita it says that if one appreciates, even just appreciates the activities, you know, of a Sankirtan devotee, that person gets the same benefit as that Sankirtan devotee.
And similarly, can you say the person who stays back at home and takes care of the child, preaches to the child, that's also preaching. You're taking care of a child,
yeah,
so that the child is Krishna conscious, you're preaching to the child, you're spending time with
him. If someone's out in the street preaching, and his wife is at home looking after the child, it facilitates that person to preach. Because he knows his child's getting looked after properly. And if that doesn't happen, it impedes his preaching, or her preaching.
No, even if, say, the husband and wife have to stay home.
Yeah.
I mean, they
have... If husband and wife sometimes have... Yeah, so that's right. So, you know... In other words, you know, say someone is... say Satsrut Maharaj, he used to work in the, you know, as I think, you know, he was, I forget exactly what it was, but some office job, and that was related to writing and, you know, clerical and stuff. His income was supporting the temple. One time he thought, oh, you know, the devotees, they're, you know, in the temple. This is right in the early days, you know, 26 Second Avenue or something. And he's thinking, oh, they're getting the association with Prabhupada, they're listening to Prabhupada's preaching, they're going out with Prabhupada to the preaching engagements, they're going out, and I'm just here in the office. So one day he comes to Prabhupada and says, Prabhupada, you know, I've quit my job so that I can, you know, sort of join in on that, those Sankirtan activities with you. And Prabhupada explained to him that actually his income was pretty much the only income the temple had, and that it was supporting all of their preaching activities. And therefore Satsarup understood, and he went back and got his job back, and you know, so he understood. So it's like that. Don't leave your job, which is, and go out on the street preaching and muck up your job you're supposed to be doing. You know, don't leave your baby. You know, it's like there are supporting roles that need to go on, and it, you know, it's better those, you know, sometimes those devotees in those supporting roles, it's not that they're not getting the benefit of the preaching. So imagine how happy Prabhupada was that he's living in, he's there in 26 Second Avenue. He's got a place to reside in America, which is like a lifetime dream, fulfilling his spiritual master. He's preaching, he's got disciples preaching, and this Satsrut Maharaj is basically funding the whole thing. How much benefit is he going to get? Massive. So don't falsely go out on the street preaching Bhagavad Gita and give up that job. Don't, you know, those supporting roles, you know, don't give them up. You know, don't give up the baby and go out, you know, preaching, you know, Krishna consciousness. Don't, you know, stop serving the husband or your wife or things like that. You know, so... some can directly preach and some serve the preachers. You know, when you've got a new baby, you're not going to, you know, most of your time you're going to be with that baby. You put the baby to sleep, you wake the baby up, you feed the baby, you know. That goes on for, you know, so many months. If that person wants to, you know, put that aside and go out and directly preach the Gita, you know, it's disruptive. Don't do that. Be practical.
Because in even in the book marathon, there, I heard people, you know, who are having babies, small babies, put the baby in the pram, put the books in the pram, and go out to a book distribution.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Well, you know, if the baby's happy. You know, it depends how old the baby is. I mean, you know, when you have a young baby, it's not good to take a
so
very...
it depends on the scenario.
It depends on how old the baby is.
So long as the baby is not affected.
Yeah, if the baby's, you know, happy at that age and they're, you know, like a very young baby is susceptible to diseases and, you know, you don't want them outside too much or in public or with... you don't even want a lot of people in your home. So very careful. But, you know, when you get to, like, 3, 4, 5 years old, you take a stroll with a baby, they love it. It's actually, you know, you got to take them for a walk anyway. You may as well throw a few books in the pram and sell a few books down the park. You know? So, you know, they're different scenarios. It's not that every woman who has a baby has to follow Prabhupada's instruction that you can't preach. But in some cases, you know, Prabhupada, you know, is straightforward. So this is where, this is where... you know, why we study like we're doing. In other words, what I would like to do in these circumstances is to read all the letters that Prabhupada wrote to women with children, you know, or in similar circumstances who wanted to preach. I'd like to read all the letters and get an overall view of a variety of different instructions so that you can see, you know, that Prabhupada said this in this circumstance, and then you... what I like to do also is to read the Leelamrita and see if that's mentioned somewhere, you know, and there's a little bit more information about it. One of the dangers we have is where, you know, one thing is quoted, disregarding so much literature, especially in the books, Prabhupada's purports and what have you, disregarding other letters, disregarding, you know, conversations, disregarding lectures. You know, it's just a quote out of context with not a lot of background. You know, that's where the academic integrity can disappear. So, it's good to know these quotes, but it's good to know them in a good context and in context with the overall philosophy, and that's why we have these discussions. And the problem is that most people will quote those sort of things. A lot of devotees have one quote on a subject, and that quote is, you know, quite often something like that, and it's from a letter or this or that or the other. Have you got one? They might have two, you know. But what they should have is a real broad understanding of Prabhupada's quotes from Prabhupada's books that show a real broad understanding, and from his lectures and letters like that. That's what they should have, a good overall view of many of the statements and the main statements that Prabhupada wanted like that. Mm. That's the difference. That's why we do these classes, so that we can...
so even about the families who would like to preach, it's not that just because of the children they should become so attached and they should become... see, you have both sides. That they should spend some time when they have the ability to preach, but they should not neglect their family. So what is the criteria that you can judge that? Okay,
in general...
some people can go this way, some other people can go the other way.
Yeah. In general, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that one who preaches is most dear to me. They'll never... so we have to take that as very significant. Therefore, let's all go out and preach as, you know, one of the main services. And that distinguishes ISKCON from everything. Right? So that's a primary service. And, you know, Prabhupada, if you look at his letters, if you, you know, and his conversations and his lectures, you know, leave 3 or 4 men in the temple, you know, someone can cook, someone can eat. Everyone else go out and sankirtan. You know, Prabhupada had that sort of a mood, you know, just... you won't find that he's, you know, most of you stay back and, you know, like this, you know, and one or two go. He was, you know, everyone go out on sankirtan and preach and, you know, leave a few people in the temple like that. You know, he was more inclined that way. So when you get, you know, those statements where Prabhupada's saying you can't preach or, you know, here's the lady with the baby, they're more the exception, you know, that although he wants everyone to preach, you know, he still lets us know, okay, there's some, you know, a little bit of qualification and other factors that we have to bear in mind that can be there, especially when you're dealing with, you know, delicate little babies and what have you. So there are other factors. And we gave the example with Satsarup, you know, that rather than going out and directly preaching, you know, just earning that income, because it was supporting everything. Now, if your income is not supporting the whole temple, and doesn't really matter to the temple what your income is, you're in a whole different boat. Oh, Prabhupada said to Satsarup Maharaj, you know, don't give up your job and don't go out and preach like we're doing, you know. So that's what I'm doing. I say, well, how much money do you give to the temple? Nothing. Well, how is it similar? So Prabhupada was in the mood, you know, as far as preaching, you know, Prabhupada was also, you know, he wanted everyone to preach because, as we said, most devotees that went out and preached in the association of other devotees they were learning from. So get out there and preach. We have a different scenario now. You know, people, you know, there's very little in some temples, you know, tendency to have, you know, respect and admiration and the tendency to want to hear and learn from others. I mean, I find that, you know, I find that all the time. It's very rare. You know, I was on the farm for, you know, managing the farm for some years, and I was the only one who ever managed it without asking money from Melbourne. So I generated an income by myself. You know, and I was doing 5 university programs, all the catering, all the, you know, those bishat, which now Melbourne does. I started the retreat program. I did all the local fairs, and I was doing yoga courses up in Ballarat and, you know, different places like that. And I was generating, and I was looking after 40 cows. And, you know, the only question that anyone has ever asked me, and I planted those 10,000 blue gums and fixed the dam, so many things. And the only question that anyone has ever, although no one's ever been able to do anything like that, even with, you know, 60 devotees on the farm and thousands of dollars coming in, the only question that anyone has ever asked me was Veda Priya, Kesava's wife, who even passes it, how the hell did you ever mow the grass like that? And, you know, how the hell did you ever keep the grass down? She couldn't even understand how I did that. No one has ever asked me any other question. And that's the usual state of things that I see. That, you know, generally, from what I see, you know, these days, even among senior devotees, there's a tendency to want a lot of credit and recognition for the projects that they're doing, and therefore if they ask someone or get assistance, it's almost like there's a fear that they may have to share the credit, so they don't ask.
That is very much so, Prabhu.
Yeah.
People don't want, even our God brothers, they don't want to tell recipes because, oh, what I'm cooking nicely, you will cook. And I don't want that happening.
You know, it's a completely different mood to when I joined. Yeah,
it's so
totally different. It is, yeah. A very
so competitive.
Yeah. So,
I don't want to tell what I'm teaching my kid because I want my kid
yeah.
to be unique.
Now, in my point is, in this environment, in that environment, you have to be more careful who you're asking to go out and preach. Because they're not like the old days where you went out in the company of devotees from day one and you, you know, happily, you know, like a sponge, just, you know, everything they said, everything they did, you know, and even if you didn't agree with those devotees, you know, some people, even if you didn't agree with them or you felt that, you know, there was something a little amiss about what they were saying or the preaching techniques, you still, you know, quietly listened and just, you know, out of respect. And, you know, you may not, okay, I don't think that person's as good a preacher as the other one, but, you know, I'm certainly not going to criticise them or pick them up or anything. That's not my position with that. So in that environment, you know, people could come to the movement and go out preaching. But strangely enough today, people can actually go through and do different courses, as you're saying, and I'd still be hesitant to get them out preaching because they actually won't take proper training from devotees who have experience in the field. It's almost like a... not only were they not, there's an aversion to it.
No, whatever charity is, it's not that just, you know, the theoretical shastra knowledge, but you have to have that maturity that's also part of...
And authorization.
So that comes in the authorization.
Yeah. There's maturity, there's also authorization. The whole process that we follow is that, you know, when devotees allowed you to speak, so, you know, you say something and then you spoke, you're authorized. Now, you know, you that whole process is you know, not there. So where's the authorization? There's a general authorization, as I said. The father says to the son, I would like you to be a doctor when you get older. So they just take it. They get older, they don't go to medical school, and they just go out and, you know, start cutting people's tonsils out. So yes, Krishna is authorizing everyone to preach, Lord Chaitanya is authorizing everyone to preach, the Guru is authorizing, Prabhupada is authorization, giving authorization. Still you can't preach. The ability to preach is not there until the person actually gets some training and authorization from their local devotees properly. There may be preaching, but will it be effective? And sometimes will it be, you know, anti-productive? In other words, you know, sometimes when there's preaching that goes on, so people, you know, for instance, we were discussing the other day that, you know, Krishna consciousness is quite easily and very attractive. If in our preaching, we preach in such a way that people, say, even if they've been around for a few years and they feel this is just so hard, Krishna consciousness is too difficult, then they go away, you know, and they won't come back because, I don't ever want to get involved in that again. They're just, God, it's so hard, you know, it's like that. So what have we done to that person? You know, better, you know, so... Sometimes, you know, what is the effect of the preaching? You know, even when it's coming on. You know, that verse also indicates that no one can preach without being authorized or empowered. That's not saying that a person can't sit there and talk about Krishna all day. What it's saying is that you won't get the results. You know? So you can preach till the cows come home, but because the authorization is there, the empowerment is not there. Empowerment means the results that should come from preaching will not come. And the results from preaching, what is that? That instead of people remaining materialistic Kanishta Adhikaris and expanding a movement of Kanishta Adhikaris, a preacher will actually change the hearts of people and they become genuine good quality devotees. That's preaching. And, you know, there are statements that, you know, by Prabhupada that, you know, if you expand the movement with, you know, just expand the movement of Kanishta Adhikaris, basically the movement will collapse in upon itself. So, you know, so what is the end result of that? If that's where we go, if Prabhupada's saying, if that sort of preaching, you know, ineffective, but you expand in Kanishtha Adhikara, it's sort of people remain on the materialistic platform, although there's so many people coming. That's the end result. So it appears to be wonderful, it appears to be expanding, but the end result we don't want. Better it expands not, you know, like that, but the people who are coming into contact with this kind, it's changing their hearts and they're becoming genuine people, honest people. You know, either in their families, you know, and they're nice representatives of ISKCON. So, yes, so, you know, that's a mood and mission statement there. And as you can see, there's a lot to it. Like that. How are we going for time? Are we pretty much finished? Yeah, what are we up to? Yeah, we have, yeah. So, all right, what did we get up to? We got up to, so we're up to verse 45, and we'll finish up that next time we meet. What's that?
Nine more.
Yeah, there's nine more verses, but I think the children are probably waiting for us. We'll finish up those nine verses pretty quick next week, and then we'll move into chapter 5. Right. Yeah, you want to do that?
Yeah,
sure. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Is that typing? Is it?